This interview is being conducted with Major Keith A. Smith by Gunnery Sergeant Floyd N. Jordan at Marine Corps Schools, Quantico, Virginia, on 25 January 1966. The subject of this interview is the move into MAG 16 in Da Nang area by VMFA and is unclassified. Would you state your name, grade, and service number, please, sir?
Keith A. Smith, Major, 057909.
What were your duty assignments while you were in Vietnam, sir?
Operations Officer, VMFA 531.
What period did you serve in these billets, and where were you physically located within Vietnam during this period, sir?
For the purposes of this interview, I was in this capacity from 10 April to 14 June 1965, the period the squadron was in Da Nang.
Would you comment on the move with the VMFA, sir?
That the move itself was extremely smooth. We got in our initial notification verbally from the wing at 1000 India on 10 April 1965. The airplanes, the first echelon of F-4Bs, departed within 3 hours en route direct utilizing in-flight refueling. The remaining 11 F-4 aircraft were airborne less than 1 hour later and proceeded via Naha Naval Air Facility in Okinawa, NAS QB Point in the Philippines. All 15 aircraft were in place and being uploaded with conventional ordnance at Da Nang by 1600 Hotel on 11 April. The initial elements of the troop lift arrived simultaneous with the fighter, with the tactical aircraft. The main body of personnel upon arrival commenced to construct the tent camp for living conditions, mess, shower, and so forth. It's located on the southeast perimeter of the airbase. Tent erection and utilities construction commenced immediately, simultaneous with an all-out maintenance effort to prepare shop areas, equipment, and aircraft for the initial combat effort. This organizational effort was accomplished well ahead of what we had expected, in spite of some limitations in transportation facilities. In this line, we took our initial messing facilities on the opposite side of the field, which accomplished a 12-mile round trip for meals. This could have been alleviated with the availability, had the appropriate field rations been available, but the decision was made to eat out of the MAG 16 mess. The first combat missions by the Chieftain Phantoms were at 1228 Hotel on the 13th of April, just 69 hours after departure from Japan. It's interesting to note here that much of the prior liaison that made this move particularly easy was accomplished by a liaison visit during the last week in March in 65. I was a member of this advance party representing a group that the wing, first wing, sent down there. During the period there, we selected the hangar spaces, the site for the TASDEF, the ramp spaces for the tactical airplanes, the campsite, and made an estimate of transportation and support that we'd need prior to the arrival of our surface lift. The camp construction in the initial part of our move presented the biggest problem. It was a max workload, and of course the object of our being there was support the ground forces, so simultaneous with getting the airplanes ready for operations, we were building a place to live. In summary, the move-in under the piecemeal phasing that our tactical forces were being put into Vietnam at that time, this was extremely smooth.
Your unit did not operate in a TAOR as such, but you had a comment you wished to make in regard to the use of a base platoon.
Yes, I think possibly the effectiveness of such an organization is underestimated. We organized a regular defense platoon with platoon commanders and squad leaders and the whole spectrum of a ground organization. We organized the terrain around our campsite, which was on the field perimeter, built in automatic weapons sites, and individual fighting positions, trench lines, command and communications trenches, ammunition storage bunkers were dug and sandbagged. This type of defense platoon, not employed full time, can be a very effective defense measure in penetrations that we've experienced in the air base areas such as the ones on Monkey Mountain.
During our preliminary interview, we talked in regard to pilot training, and you indicated there was a rather unique experience here for a specialized training or a training which isn't presently being given to pilots. Would you make a comment here, sir?
I believe that the air crews should be prepared for the type of operations that we're running over, that we are conducting in Vietnam, a little more extensively than what the present training program permits. I would recommend possibly a 5-hour instruction period from an intelligence representative to cover the type of ops, strictly conventional, no nuclear or clandestine operations as such. The average target that we're up against, which is a small group of personnel, extremely light weapons, rapid moving, and not a fixed, defined situation. The rules of engagement that we are required to operate under, and the restrictions that they incur. And once again, the need to emphasize that this is strictly a conventional operations situation. It's the impact that this has on the young pilot, especially his first tour in a tactical squadron, his first tour overseas, must be psychologically prepared for the limited role that he's going to can be expected to play in adverse weather conditions in what seems to him like might not really be needed for. A few words on this in the States to prepare him mentally before he gets in the cockpit in poor weather with what he'll find out later is a difficult target to justify would be a big asset to him.
Would you comment in the case of a Hilo escort missions participated in by your unit, sir?
We found shortly after we arrived there that the Hilo escort was going to occupy a greater portion of our time. The problems associated with this Hilo escort are threefold: target acquisition, support aircraft delivery capability, and the swift, accurate delivery of the ordnance required. I'll cover these in parts. The landing zone preparation. A flight by the helicopter to the intended zone of landing is usually a sufficient height to preclude accurate ground fire. During this phase of flight, it is recommended that the landing zone be neutralized by concentrated saturation bombing, napalm rocket, or 20-millimeter cannon fire. The F-4B is presently without the capability of delivering any cannon fire and is limited to rockets, bombs, and napalms. I will note here that the addition of some aircraft cannon to the F-4B weapon system, and specifically not of the high-peg rapid-fire type, would be a tremendous asset for the weapon system. In landing zone preparation, it is important to have the support fire cease just prior to the first wave of helicopters touching down. This prevents or delays enemy regrouping for concentrated fire on the choppers. The normal pattern as is described as follows. The movement during the briefing, the Hilo commander describes the tactics that he'll use in the zone. Then the cover airplanes determine the pattern they'll fly, and generally it is a tilted pattern. It can be either left or right hand, depending on the terrain over which they have to fly. The main object of the pattern being to provide an aircraft, or if, depending upon the size of the zone, 2 or 3 airplanes, in a firing position no more than 15 seconds apart. Preparation strikes by the support aircraft will commence sometime prior to the chopper touchdown in generally 2 to 8 minutes, depending upon the intelligence information on the zone. The helicopter commander generally times this and calls for the landing zone preparation. Each 15 seconds thereafter, until the helicopter commander calls for the lift of fire, firing passes will be made on suspected or likely areas of enemy resistance. This will allow roughly if a two-hour time is used, 7 passes by the supporting aircraft prior to the helicopters arriving in the landing zone. Needless to say, timing is of the utmost importance, as the helicopter is most vulnerable just prior to landing and while they're engaged in landing troops. Escort from the initial point to the landing zone. Using photographs and available intelligence, probable areas of enemy infestation and resistance can usually be determined. The escort aircraft, usually a flight of 3 in the operations we were conducting, will take up a left-hand orbit over the helicopter flights at the initial point, an airspeed of 350 knots. This is for the F-4. A tight pattern over the flights of helicopters and landing zone is required for ease of target acquisition. For this reason, 3 aircraft are considered the maximum number over the helicopters at any one time, presuming that the helicopter lift does not exceed 12 airplanes. Each aircraft, 120 degrees apart. Experience has shown that this is roughly 15 seconds. Due to the possible necessity of providing support fire in close proximity to the helicopters, ordnance loads will consist of rockets, 2.75 Zunis, napalm, and 20-millimeter cannon. The use of GP bombs for this type of work is precluded to prevent inadvertent damage to helicopters. The aircraft will be orbiting or at roll-in altitude. Selection of ordnance for fire suppression will be at the discretion of the flight leader, who must at all times be aware of the inherent dangers to friendlies. This requires extremely close coordination between the escort aircraft and flight leader and the helicopter or helolift commander. Upon call of the proper controlling agency or the helicopter being fired on, the aircraft in the most advantageous position for roll-in will be prepared to return fire. The chopper will mock the enemy position with smoke, execute a 90-degree turn away from the direction of the incoming fire, if it can be determined, and provide amplifying instructions. The aircraft having the most advantageous position will call target in sight and call rolling in hot. The importance of immediate accurate reaction cannot be overemphasized. Quick silencing of enemy fire instills confidence in the helicopter pilots, crews, and delays the flight at the minimum time possible. Target acquisition is difficult at best, so by eyeing potential trouble spots such as groves of trees, ditches, trenches, or huts, and houses in close proximity to the landing zone. Experience has shown that the enemy is reluctant to place himself in the open when dealing with fighter attack type cover aircraft. Tactics in the landing zone. As the helicopter arrives in the landing zone, the flight leader will commence low run-ins, commencing with the right side of the lead helicopter, or the side offering the greater enemy threat, in the same direction as the helicopter flight is flying. The aircraft will then alternate sides with the pullout direction being dictated by the terrain. In instances where a choice is available, all out pullouts will be to the left unless otherwise dictated by the flight leader. Run-ins will be flown at 350 knots, downwind leg being flowing at 280 knots. The leader will pass to the right of the first run, wing to the left, and alternating thereafter. The Viet Cong are known to have a maniacal fear of napalm, and the demoralizing effect of low passes in the landing zone are usually sufficient to keep their heads down. It is interesting to note here that a large percentage of our escort missions, no ordnance was required, strictly from the suppression factor, the support of the escort airplanes being in the air. Also, the effect of seeing F-4s flying as low or lower than they are is a confidence builder in the chopper pilots. In any event, at least one aircraft should be in a position for attack at all times, and both sides of the zone should be effectively covered. The first fighter to spot the next to the last helicopter element lifting from the landing zone calls reverse. The object of this maneuver is to alert the escort airplanes that the helos are lifting out of the zone and the direction of support will change 180 degrees. Great deal of discretion is required here to give the helicopters room to work. Passes that are made closer than 100 meters are really not required in this. However, the supporting aircraft must be alert and ready at all times to resume or assume the attack. Or cockpit ordnance switches, gun sights set for the ordnance you intend to use, and ready to deliver it as required. Weapons delivery and ordnance conservation. Quick, accurate fire, as mentioned previously, is an absolute necessity. Once the fire has been suppressed, keep the area under surveillance and continue the mission unless otherwise directed. Mission responsibility. The requirement laid down by the helicopter escort is to provide safe operation for the chopper. If this can be accomplished by the mere presence of the fighter aircraft, so be it.
Did you make a comment in regard to communications? Any difficulties or general comments you have to make in the form of communications, sir?
Right. In this category, I'll cover the general communications and also the coordination affected for our utilization when we first arrived. I believe that the capacity of communication system existing by the brigade, later on by the MAF, by MAG 16, were incapable of handling the traffic required. In this situation, where the supply lines and communication lines are so long and electronic communications are mandatory, the volume of traffic must be handled. It was possible during the latter part of March to depart Da Nang and arrive at Tsugi physically prior to an immediate message which I had sent prior to departing the area down there. Now then, for the coordination. Upon our arrival there, we established liaison with 1 ASOC, which is in I Corps headquarters. This is the Vietnamese facility staffed also by liaison officers of the U.S. forces. When we first arrived, our line of communications for operational purposes went from our squadron ready room to 1 ASOC headquarters, the 2nd Air Division in Saigon, and to the TOC down there. As the days passed, MAG 16 became more and more integrated and interested in the problems of our problems and the usage of our assets. So we then wired in MAG 16 as a strictly on a liaison basis to this net. Any of our assignments for operational use were sent to 1 ASOC and then to us and to Saigon for the issuance of the frag orders which we operated off of. These frag orders were issued under the authority of the 2nd Air Division. About 3 weeks later, about 4 weeks later, the initial elements of the wing started to arrive, and the first steps in proper coordination and control were initiated. To accomplish this, wire was laid for positive communications with the wing. At this time, we had a net to land wire net to the wing, to MAG 16 S3, and to 1 ASOC. However, our authority still came from 1 ASOC for all of our aviation, all of our support work. We had at this time aircraft on different status of alert, deck alert, or conventional weapons loaded. We did not have an air defense role as a primary air defense role. All of our airplanes had an air defense capability, but were not tasked as such. The next step then involved the integration of a modified DASC, which the communications was supported by the LAM battalion. This then involved another land line, which ran its gave us communications with the DASC as such in the LAM battalion. So now we had communications with 1 ASOC, with First Wing 3, with MAG 16 3, and with the DASC. Our authority still remained with 1 ASOC. About the 15th of May, or roughly 2 weeks later, the First Wing assumed operational control and authority of 531. Now, I speak of this authority here as launch authority and frag authority for the operations that we conducted. Up until this time, we operated strictly from the 2nd Air Division frag orders. This caused considerable consternation. This being our being fragged by 2nd Air Division caused considerable confusion and consternation on the part of the Marines who we were there to support. In essence, it meant that all of our assets or all of our capabilities were in support of the 2nd Air Division. When the wing entered the picture about the middle of May, I believe it was, this changed and got into its proper perspective. From that time on, the wing gathered and assimilated and put into a wing frag order the requirements for support that the Marine ground forces were asking for the next 24-hour period. This happened along about 2000 of the day preceding. By 2400, we generally had a frag order from the wing that told us what we were expected to provide in support of the MAF for the following 24-hour period. Any assets that were available above and beyond the requirements laid on at this point were turned over to 1 ASOC and forwarded to I Corps, forwarded to 2nd Air Division in Saigon, where once again we appeared on the 2nd Air Division frag order for some missions. It's interesting to note here that the volume of missions in our total effort over there, in the total effort for the time we were in Da Nang, ran something like this. These are missions, not sorties now. USMC close air support was 14, Hilo escort 61, TPQ radar bombing night 19, third MAF alert scrambles, these were the deck alert airplanes we had on standby, 15, interdiction 195, these were second air division missions solely. U.S. forces alert scrambles were 12, these were deck alert airplanes utilized whenever any U.S. force personnel were in trouble. RESCAP 3, convoy escort 6, these were all of the convoy escorts were in support of Marine forces. In-country strikes 3, these were 2nd Air Division controlled. Search and attack 5, and these were 2nd Air Division controlled. So that the total operational sorties completed 959, total missions 333. So that you can see a large percentage of them were 2nd Air Division controlled. This balance has changed considerably since 531 has departed there. Now more on the control. After the wing assumed the control and wrote frag orders for Marine support, we were still having considerable confusion as to who we were working for, on what priority, and at what times. So within a two-day period of time, we resolved with the wing that they would write the entire frag order for all of our efforts. This solved a lot of problems, and a step that should have taken place the first week we were in Da Nang. We realize here, of course, that the piecemeal integration of forces to Vietnam was a limiting factor on the assets that the wing could put in place. The mere presence of a single officer from the G3 section of the wing with command responsibility could have solved this problem for us early in the game. More on the coordination. The landline communications that we had with the agencies then, after the wing decided that they would frag us for all operations, were removed. So then we had direct line only to 1st MAW G3 and to the improvised desk that was handled, desk provided by the LAM battalion. This facilitated our operations a great deal, and things ran very smoothly after that. Now, in response to the volume of mission requests that we were demanded or asked for in support of Marine forces, we resolved that the capability of the squadron far exceeded the operation tempo, and about 50% of our daily efforts we could provide in support of the 2nd Air Division. They readily accepted these, and we continued to operate with the coordination that should have been implemented much before. So in summary, coordination and our move-in could have been facilitated by, one, an officer from the G3 section of the 1st MAW with command capability and responsibility to function as our link and the controlling link between the squadron and the helicopter squadrons included here, VMO squadrons, the land battalions, with the all other agencies to which we had to work. This would have been a tremendous workload for the one officer, I admit. However, he could have trained or used duty officers from the squadrons that were on hand. Second, the communications should be established, and communications for control purposes should be established to a single agency. Whether that agency is the squadron commander, the group commander, a staff commander on the MEB or the MAF staff is inconsequential at this point. The channel must go through one agency. The theory of having four command channels to one squadron just does not work. The squadron is incapable of responding to four different people telling them to do four different things with the same assets at the same time. Third, that the physical move of the airplanes, the personnel, was extremely smooth, due in large part to the prior liaison visit by the task force sent down by the wing during the last week in March.
Would you have any general comment or advice to offer, since this now places you in the category of being the man with the experience? If you encountered an individual now who had orders to the same billet which you occupied, would you have any general sage words of advice to pass to him to make his lot a little easier, sir?
Yes, I would. First, whether he's going to the squadron, group, wing, or MAF, go to the first to the gent that he works for and find out what the command channels are and who is in line next. When you find out who's next in line, pay a social visit with the guy, identify himself, and tell him what his job is, and complete this step all the way up the ladder till he winds up with the one gent that has final authority over what he does or what the forces that he commands do in support of our efforts in Vietnam. There is no substitute for the personal, individual, liaison effort that it only takes a few hours to expend to find out who you're going to be working with, when, where, and why. Secondly, I would strongly recommend that right after he does this, that he become thoroughly familiar with other supporting arms in Vietnam. Air Force, first, tactical squadrons, and there are generally representatives, if not a large number of Air Force forces at Da Nang. Talk to them, talk to their officers, his like number, if it's an ops officer, talk to their ops officer and to their squadron commander, and learn from them what they're doing, how they're doing it, why they're doing it, and what they're doing it with. We found a tremendous ally in the Air Force squadron, the F-100 squadron, that occupied the same ramp that we did. And when it came around to some of our experiences in night close air support under the flares, which we'd not been trained for, this was a valuable source of information for us. After he's done this, to visit the I-Corps headquarters and find out who is who out there, what radio they talk on, what telephone they talk on, and what their job is in relation to what he'll be doing. Once again, there's no substitute for knowing who, when, where, why, and how. It just facilitates everything that he does.
Thank you very much, sir.